they are considered to be Avraham Avinu's progeny in some level, they are supposed to remain in their land until such time as Mashiach comes, after which we will get the land of Moab as well. So the Shem Mishmor, one of the great Hasidic Rebbe's, asks the Kasha, if in fact Bnei Yisrael are under a divine command not to wage war against the Moabites, what is Moab afraid of? There's nothing to be afraid of. A second observation the Chafetz Chaim makes is that if I have an enemy who's going to come and destroy me, wouldn't it be to my advantage to get myself a blessing instead of cursing the other person? In other words, isn't it better to build myself up? Because when I curse the other person, that curses the other person. What about another enemy that will attack? In other words, if I get a blessing, I will be strong and invincible. That is much better than getting a blessing, a curse, that denigrates a particular nation, because that's not going to work for some other nation. So on that, the Chafetz Chaim makes the point, just to answer the second question, that that is the nature of jealousy and hatred. That you get more satisfaction out of knocking somebody down than building yourself up. Okay, that's the nature of jealousy, that we rather destroy than build. But the first question is a good question. So the Shem Mishmur offers a very interesting explanation that Balak was not afraid of a military invasion. Balak was not afraid of a war. Balak was not afraid of a defeat. Balak was afraid that he did not want Bnei Yisrael to come to the land of Israel. That was the only thing he was afraid of. I don't want them to enter Eretz Yisrael. What does he care? Let him enter Eretz Yisrael. It doesn't bother him. The Shem Mishmor says, and this is a well-known theme that reiterates itself in many, many contexts, that there's a fundamental difference between the life the Jews led in the desert and the life that they lead in the land of Israel. In the deserts, they live a spiritual cocoon. They get their man from Shemayim, and they get the traveling well of Miriam, and they have clouds of glory. There's no need to wash their clothes. There's no need to dig ditches. There's no need to build societies. What did the Jews do in the desert? Of course, they had a few interludes, the spies and Korach. I mean, not everything was that good. But by and large, the desert was a totally spiritual experience where they're serving Hashem in a way that is disembodied from physical reality.
And they still rebelled.
And they still rebelled. That's called pure ruchnius, pure spiritualism. When they come to Eretz Yisrael, what's going to happen? Hashem is, of course, still with them, much more so than in Chutz La'aretz. But at that point, they have to build a society, they have to plant, they have to harvest, they have to plow, they have to have doctors, and they have lawyers and accountants and tax collectors. They have to have an army, and the armies are going to suffer casualties, even when we're successful, etc. And therefore, the task of living in Eretz Yisrael is different than the desert in two levels. Number one, there's a hester panim. There's a certain level of the concealment of the divine. Of course, as we know, Eretz Yisrael, there is less of a hester panim than there is anywhere else. But as compared to the deserts, there's very much of a concealment of God's presence. And number two, and these are related, the Jewish people will have to take the spirituality of the Midbar and translate it into dealing with the concrete realities of everyday life. By definition, that's not going to be as spiritually elevated. Because when you're separated from all the pressures of the world, then maybe it's relatively easier to serve Hashem. Even then, they had their problems, ups and downs. But to be confronted with the need to make a living and the need to fight your enemies and not to have the open miracles and going back, that you're going to eat your bread by the sweat of your brow and still remain spiritually strong and connected to Hashem is a very, very hard avoda. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. The Shem Mishmor tells us, Balak was very happy to have the Jewish people wander in the deserts. Because he looks at a Jewish people who try to keep the Torah and he says, they are irrelevant to modern man, or you know, modern man from his perspective. They don't live a life that has real problems and real struggles and real nisyonos. They live their miraculous existence, and the fact that they serve Hashem is not a reproach to our corrupt society, because we have real issues that we have to deal with. And the Torah is irrelevant to the problems of a human being. What the chiddush that occurs when you come to Eretz Yisrael is that Bnei Yisrael can establish that Torah is not only a guide when you're not involved in the real world, but it's possible to create a Torah, a life which involves struggle and ambiguity and difficulty and confrontation with the material, and still live a life of kedusha and commitments and determination and submission to Hashem. What is the message to people like Balak? Then they see that all of their excuses, all of their arguments that the Torah is irrelevant, no longer hold water. So the Shem Yishmuel says, Balak's goal was not because he was afraid of a military defeat. Balak's goal was, he says, let the Jews stay in the deserts, but I don't want them to come to Eretz Yisrael. Because their coming to Eretz Yisrael will be a reproach to all of the excuses that the Umos HaOlam have. Now, when I say excuses, I mean, as we know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not expect non-Jews to keep the Torah. It's not an obligation. We don't proselytize. But he does expect everyone in the world to obey the seven commandments of Noach, the seven basic commandments, not killing, not stealing, believing in Hashem, setting up a court system to administer justice, not committing cruelty even to animals, such as severing the limb. In other words, Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach. The Moabite societies were not living by that standard. And they're coming, the B'nai Israel coming to Eretz Israel would have destroyed them. In fact, it's very reminiscent of a comment Theodor Herzl once made when he developed the idea of a Zionist state. So he was asked at that early point, what will be the role of the clergy and how will you assure religious liberty in your state of Palestine or Israel? So he was totally non-religious, but he was on the verge of converting to Christianity at various points. But he said that we shall confine the clergy to their synagogues just as we shall confine the army to its barracks. Of course, for good or for bad, neither part of that sentence has been true. The Israeli army has, unfortunately, I think we would say, not been confined to its barracks. Been out there all the time, and for good or for bad, the clergy has not been confined to its synagogues. They're out there. That's also for good or for bad. For good in the sense that, you know, there's so much Torah in Eretz Israel, so much learning, so much mitzvos. The bad aspect is another point, one of my hobby horses, and that is the idea of political religious parties, which, you know, I think is not such a wonderful thing as is sometimes made up to be, but be it as it may, Herzl was also taking this position that let religion be separated from life and then everything is fine. But when it starts interfering in real life, that's when we have to oppose it. This idea of sanctifying the material, you know, we've talked about this in many, many contexts. The notion that the way you serve Hashem is not by withdrawing from the world, but by dealing with the world and showing. That's why so many mitzvahs are physical. Well, why does the Torah emphasize mitzvos, taking lulav, eating matzah, eating korbanos? Right? Why don't we say one should go into a room and one should engage in transcendental meditation? One should meditate about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Why is everything translated into physical action? Because the whole message of the Torah is that we take olam hazeh, we take the materialism of this world and we sanctify it and we elevate it. We don't serve Hashem by renunciation. That's why the Nazir is called the sinner in our tradition. The Nazir, the one who takes a vow not to drink wine, is called a chayte, because the Nazir serves God by repudiation. And Hashem says, no, I created a world on which everything in this world, I said, is kitov. Everything in this world is good. And if you turn your back on it, you're saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that your world is no good. Right? That's the fundamental difference between Jewish and Christian. Well, there is a concept. Well, obviously we believe that a person, first of all, we believe that a person can overindulge in things and they can destroy them. So there has to be a moderation. But the way of Hashem is not to turn your back and repudiate, but to take and enjoy, but to sanctify with the proper motivation. Now, of course, you can always find different makaras. For example, Rashi says the Nazir is the sinner because he prohibits himself from wine. He denies himself legitimate pleasure. Ramban says very differently. The Ramban says a Nazir is a sinner because he's leaving Naziris. In other words, after he's tasted the high level of asceticism, how could he dare come back to the lowly everyday life? So you see an opposite idea, that the Ramban says the sin of the Nazir is not becoming the Nazir. The sin of the Nazir is leaving Naziris. So you do see different things, and we have contradictions even in Chazal. Chazal do talk very much about a mida, a trait that is called precious, separating from unnecessary luxuries and pleasures, not seeking, you know, too much enjoyment out of this world. And yet we also have statements like the Talmud Yerushalmi that says a person is going to be called to account. Don't tell your kids this because you may get in trouble. Is that a person will be called to account by Hashem for any pleasure he could have enjoyed in this world and did not. Hashem is going to ask you, now why didn't you do this and that and that? So next time your children want to go to Adventure World or something, they might pull out the Yerushalmi and say, got to give me $26 so Hashem won't ask me why didn't I go. Okay, but the point is though that it's not really a contradiction. It's not really a contradiction. Meaning there is a concept of not making it the focus of your life, not being obsessed, not seeking more and more, but to have a certain appreciation for the beauty of the world is something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to cultivate. That a person should not be blind to those things, because that's a lack of appreciation for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And also on a deeper spiritual sense, you sanctify this world when you use it to do mitzvahs. For example, let's say a person goes to a park and that refreshes a person and that gives them more strength to be able to daven better or learn better. So the pshat is he or she has sanctified the activity of going to the park. In other words, the Rambam writes, it's not that it's a vacation or a break. It becomes a mitzvah because you're doing it with the intention of being able to serve Hashem more. So it's a tremendous idea that the power of our thoughts can transform the whole action. Meaning, somebody takes a break, if it's just because they want a break, right? It's not an aveira, but it's not necessarily a mitzvah. But if it's done with the intention, I'm doing this so I can serve Hashem better, then it becomes, you know, the basketball game or the football game, all of that becomes a mitzvah by which you serve Hashem. So we have the power with our thoughts to transform the very activities. And again, going back to the Shem Mishmor, that's what he didn't want Bnei Yisrael to establish. Let them have pure spirituality, but not the spirituality that transforms the mundane.
At that time, the nations who were praying to idols, they did believe in our God who required of them 7 mitzvot?
Well, I think we have to say that there were different groups of people. Now, this kind of lamdasha theory was in the mind of Balak. I think we would assume, just like in many cults, the leaders of the cults are very well aware of what the truth is. But there are followers who are blindly alone. So I'm not making the point, or the Shem Shmuel is not making the point, that every single Moabite person knew of Hashem and knew there was a duty of the 7 mitzvahs of Noach, but he's suggesting that at least Balak, the kings at the higher level, had a certain awareness that they were concealing from their followers.
Even the other nations of the world, I mean Egypt.
Well, you know, it's hard to say. Certainly, I think we have a sense in Chazal that people like Nebuchadnezzar later were very well aware of Hashem. It was almost, it's a strange thing, we can't even understand the psychology. They knew of Hashem, and they knew of Hashem's power, but they wanted to defy Hashem. Now we look at that logically and we say, that doesn't make sense to me. If I know there's this omnipotent creator of the world, then what is it that I'm, how can I consciously rebel against Hashem? But you do get the sense that these were people who knew of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and consciously are trying to be moed against, rebel against Hashem. It's almost a psychological mode that we almost don't understand. In a way, even the evildoers had a certain greatness that we can't perceive. I mean, it's kind of a negative greatness. The greatness of being defiant enough to fight God. I mean, that takes a certain guts, as it were, that we don't have.
Is
Well, it seems to be a form of greatness. I mean, again, it's you're right, it's an ambiguous term. We don't want to use it in any positive. Yes, but it's a koach. We talk about koach atuma, the power of impurity. And in fact, it's been said in the different svarim, again, this is a controversial proposition, that sometimes the Russia with passion is on some level greater than the indifferent person. Because when there's passion and there's force and there's koach, even if it's misdirected, there is a force there that, if it's channeled in the right way, can turn into greatness. As opposed to the person who is without the passion and without the strength and without the force, even if they're not doing anything wrong, the potential for greatness is less because there's nothing propelling a person to movement. Again, that's a big machlokas in Svarim, whether it's proper to describe Rishon that way. But there was a concept that the kayach of the Russia, on some level, is a harnessable force, which is greater than the kayach of the one that doesn't have any particular feeling one way or the other.
Yeah, I want to ask, is there any synthesis between the tzavach and the religious?
Well, yes, I think that at least in two ways there's a very strong connection. Number one, the Torah keeps the Jewish people alive spiritually, and the army helps keep the Jewish people alive physically. They're both doing this job of preserving the Jewish people. We also believe that even the ability to engage in military success depends on spiritual help of Hashem, siyata d'shmaya. You know, I think we have to say that anyone who's willing to risk their life for the Jewish people is considered to be a righteous person
but
in many ways.
That we had with the Tzava, remember, even Mariko, they put some of the spirit on
Yoshua.
Yoshua, right? Uh-huh. So that you had always the religious with even itself from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have, again, you know, sometimes it's a bit of a false accusation when they say religious people, you know, don't serve in the army. I mean, of course, there are a lot of exemptions.
Some of them are, yeah. They put some of the spirit on Yeshua, and he would also blow the trumpets and
so forth when itself. Right. Well, the success.
I think the question is whether some religious people serve with the army is another question.
It's another question, and many, many do. That's all. Many do, and some don't. As in any army, there are exemptions, but many, many religious people serve in the army. Shame is two words. Shame Mishmuel. Right. His he was the only son of another very, very famous Hasidic Rebbe, who was the Avnei Nezer. This is the beginning of the 20th century. And the Avnei Nezer was the son-in-law of another famous Hasidic Rebbe, the Kutzker Rebbe. The Kutzker Rebbe actually is fairly well known, not in terms of his Torah so much, although his Torah is wonderful, but in terms of his very different habits. He was in seclusion for around 20 years of his life. He locked himself up in a room and very rarely came out because he says the world wasn't worth it. And so, you know, basically he very much withdrew from people, but he only saw a few people at any given time, among which was his great son-in-law, the Avnei Nezer. And the Avnei Nezer writes that everything he learned in Torah he learned from his father-in-law. So the Kutzker Rebbe was a great, great gadol, but he kind of withdrew.
And he, I ask you this before. If somebody has an old Torah life, because we have many people who are Jewish, it doesn't mean like they're not integrating themselves with the world. They chose an old Torah life where their life centers completely around Torah.
Right. Well, you know, the Rambam says that just like there was Shevet Levi, that all the Jews had land and they worked, and the tribe of Levi was set aside to totally serve Hashem, and they were supported by the rest of Bnei Israel. So the Rambam says that every generation needs individuals who are to be supported by the congregation in order to be the teachers of Torah. So clearly there is a concept of Shevet Levi that exists in the world. And then the Rambam makes the point, it is not limited to Levian. In other words, it's not a tribal thing, but rather the person who wants to devote himself. But for most of Klal Yisrael, our job is to sanctify the material world. And besides, as you point out, even those who learn Torah totally are very much involved. I mean, listen, if you eat a Shabbos meal, you take lulav, I mean, that's sanctifying the physical world. That's also what we're talking about. You're sanctifying Hashem by the physical activities that you do. I just want to mention that there's a special role for women that Chazal see in this capacity to sanctify the physical aspects of reality. There's a beautiful thought from the Maharal. This first part is a Gemara, which I'm sure you've heard at Sheva Brachas. And that is, we say Ish and Isha, man and woman. So the two common letters are Aleph Shin, which is fire, Ish. And the Yod of the Ish is Yod, and the Hey of woman. Yod and Hey are God's name. So the Gemara makes the beautiful observation that when they bring God into their relationship, there's a man and a woman who interact and grow. But if you take God out of the relationship, take the Yud and the Hey out of their name, all you have is Eish, destructive fire, fire of dissension, machlokes, hatred, as each one is only looking out for themselves, and they eventually destroy each other in that animosity. So that's the Gemara. That's a very beautiful thought. But the Maharal takes the thought a little further. That is, why is it though, Yud and Hey are God's name, but why is it that the man gets the Yud of the God's name and the woman gets the Hey of God's name? Why that division? So he says like this. He says, there's a Gemara, another Gemara, that says, God created Olam Haba. God created the world to come with the force of the letter Yud. Yud is the letter, the spiritual letter, through which God creates Olam Haba. Hey is the spiritual letter through which God creates Olam Hazeh, this world.
In fact, the books of Moses.
Right, that's right, the Torah is for this world. Okay. In fact, that's the meaning of the Pasuk, Ki Baka Hashem Tzur Olamim, Ka is Yud, with Yud and Hey, Tzur Olamim, God created both worlds. Now, why is, of course we don't understand the process of God drawing on letters to create the world, but nevertheless we do know that the Aleph Beis was the building blocks out of which the world was created. Now, why is Yud Olam Haba and Hey Olam Hazeh? So the Gemara explains, Yud is a little dot. Yud does not have any real spatial dimensions. That's the spiritual world, which is not bounded by length and width. Hey is an interesting letter. Hey is totally open at the bottom, and there's a narrow little opening at the upper left side. And that teaches us something about life, that it's very easy to make a misstep. You'll drop out of the bottom, right? It's very easy to do aveiros. The Chazon Ish says almost humorously that he kind of almost complained a little bit, that if a person wanted to develop bad midas, there would really be nothing you have to do at all. It would just come naturally. He says, give yourself a little bit of time and you'll develop, you know, the maximum level of selfishness and egotism. And Guy says, there's no work that you have to put into it. He says, midas tovos, you know, take so much work. That's what he's saying. That the upper left hand is the way to reach Hashem is very narrow sometimes. The bottom is very big, very easy to fall down. That's Olam Hazeh. But the Maharal adds it. The Maharal adds to that, and I'll come back to man and woman, and he says like this. He says, Hey is really a composite of two letters. Dalet, and the little thing is Yud. I would say Vav, but he says Yud.
Oh, okay.
So he says like this. Yud is pure spirituality. Dalet is pure materialism, because you talk about the four dimensions of time, four directions, north, south, east, west. We talk about length, width, height, and time. Matter exists in four dimensions. So Dalet is materialism. Yud is spirituality. Hey is therefore the integration of the Yud into the Dalet. And he says, therefore, that a man, these are generalizations, and I know that in our generation we don't like to generalize, but as a generalization, The Maharal makes this point. A man tends to be corrupted by the external environment of the world. The rat race, the possessiveness, the competitiveness, they drag a person down. So a man generally has to achieve spiritual recharging by separation and disengagement from the world. Go to yeshiva, go to kollel, even go to shul. Notion of separating from that world out there, which pulls you down and corrupts you. So that's why the man gets the letter Yud, because Yud is pure Ruchnius, Olam Haba. The woman's capacity, Maral writes, is that she could bring the Yud into the Dalit. She has the capacity to take the ethereal spiritual truths of the Torah and translate them into the concrete realities of life, in terms of raising children, establishing a home, creating an environment, things which can drive a man sometimes away from serving Hashem, can be a way in which the woman can serve Hashem in a way that men cannot. And the Maral says, part of the Ezer Kenegdo, the helpmate, that a woman is to a man, is to teach the man how to serve Hashem in the physical ways of life. You know, diapering a baby, taking a child somewhere, that is a way of serving Hashem, which is not natural to a zachar, to a male, but that's something which the male can be habituated and can learn. So this notion, going back to the Shem Yishmol, this notion of sanctifying the material, we see there's a special avoda here that women have, that is the hay. Now, one thing is very interesting, to go into the numerological aspects of it. On one level, the hay is only half the amount of the yud, right? Yud is 10, hay is 5. What that tells you is that having to serve Hashem in the middle of all of the physical details of life is not going to be as immediately rewarding. It's not going to be a 10, so to speak. It'll be a 5, because the mind is distracted and you're pulled in many, many different ways. And there's a sacrifice there. But ultimately, it's more meaningful, because it was the very purpose of this world that we bring Hashem into this world. You see, in other words, there's a cost here. The cost is, it's not going to be as ecstatic, it's not going to be as a high, constant set of high, but it's ultimately more meaningful. As the Baal HaTanya writes, the purpose of this world is Hashem had a taiva, Hashem had a desire to have a dira, to have a dwelling place in this world. You see, so, in fact, I can even go further. We could even explain this with Sarai.
Yes, yeah. Say, when we discuss Sarai,
that's exactly right. The Yud of Sarai, right, Sarah's name was Sarai, and Avraham's name was Avram, without the hay. Right. So after the mitzvah of Bris Milah, the name of Avram and Sarai were changed, and the Medrash actually says the Yud of Sarai was divided into two hays. Avraham, Sarah, and this goes to the concept like this, that the capacity of sanctifying the physical, and it's connected with Bris Milah and Sarah's fertility, because basically the concept is this: before Sarah was a mother, so to speak, her goal was self-development, internal spirituality, kind of a masculine spirituality, which is represented by the Yud. The division of the hays represents the renewed capacity of Sarah, both as a mother, and Avraham's circumcision. Circumcision is also a symbol which involves the ability to sanctify even the physical, sexual aspects of living. And therefore, they both achieved new vistas in terms of the hay, the capacity of sanctifying the physical. So it's connected to that.
I thought Yud was added to Hosea.
Yeah, that
was...
just pointing out that Yehoshua's name was originally Hosea ben Nun, and Moshe added a Yud to make it Yehoshua ben Nun. Yeah, that's a little different. I don't have a connection to what I'm saying now. That, Rashi says, was Moshe knew that the Meraglim might come back with a bad report, so he wanted Yehoshua to have Hashem's name as a prayer that Yehoshua should be protected from the evil counsel of the spies. That's what Rashi says.
This concept of the man being the Yud and separating completely
right.
from the material world
right.
and then is able to reach a 10, let's say,
right.
spiritually. Is that the ideal for a man to to separate? And, you know, like, if they don't, are they going to be a one?
Well, the morale is saying, I think the morale is saying that the dangers of a man facing the world are greater than the dangers of a woman. But the ultimate ideal is hey for everybody. That's the division. And that's the Azer Connector, where a man learns from his wife, from a marriage, how to get involved in this world in a holy way.
But is it unhealthy for him or wrong if he is just the, you know, totally separated?
Well,
you know?
It may be a legitimate decision based on the lesser of two evils. But in a way, it's an evil. In other words, in a sense, I'll give you an example. You could find in the Rambam, for example, a very strong passage which sharply condemns the idea of kolo. I mean, the Rambam basically says, in very, very strong words, that a person who says, I'm going to learn all day and have the tzibur, have the congregation support me, the Rambam calls that a chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name. He calls it a bizayon, a humiliation of the Torah. And the Rambam writes that the way of a true Talmud Chacham is to work and make a living and be supported and learn. Right? So you could pick the Rambam and say the Rambam would close every kollel in the world, unless you're getting supported by your father-in-law, maybe. But if you're getting supported by public funds, the Rambam says it's usher. And yet, we Baruch Hashem, we have many, many kollelim. So already, all the commentaries say that like this. In an ideal world, it is the derech of the Torah that one should work and one should be self-sufficient and one should learn whatever they can. But in a world which is so corrupt, and where when you get on into the world, there are so many things that will drag you down. And in our society, you know, the Rambam gives an example of a working person, a person who works 3 hours a day and only has 9 hours a day to study Torah. I mean, that was the Rambam's example of a working person. But that's not professional life today. So some say, okay, sitting in kollel is not the ideal, but it is the lesser of, in other words, the other thing would be worse. And that's really the cheshbon, meaning it's not the ideal that people should be sitting in kollel, but nevertheless, a case can be made. It is very important in a day and age where society is so corrupt that we do have people. It's like extremes. In other words, the concept is when you have so much of the world going to the opposite extreme, then we have to go to the opposite extreme, although the ideal would be to be in the middle. See, so that's really the problem. So the problem is, the whole world is off kilter. And if the whole world is off kilter, there is a feeling that, you know, you have to go to the other direction. But it's not the optimal. It is not the ideal situation.
The Rambam didn't work 3 hours a day. I'm remembering
his letter. That's very true. That's very true.
That letter he wrote to his translator.
That's right.
He worked all the time.
Before his brother died, that probably was right. That's a good point. The Rambam was supported by his brother for many years. His brother died at sea. His brother was a merchant. Mm-hmm. But the Rambam then became the chief physician to the Sultan in Egypt.
Yeah.
And the Rambam describes the unbelievable work schedule he had. That's very correct. Mm-hmm. That's very correct. It's a good kasha. I don't know why the Rambam was disingenuous with the 3-hour workday.
But you know, in East of Jordan, one tribe worked and one tribe supported.
You're talking about Yisachar, Yisachar and Zebulun?
Exactly.
Yeah, Yisachar. You're saying that we have the tribe of Yisachar, were the tribes that devoted themselves totally to Torah, and Zebulun was involved in commerce and merchandise, and Zebulun supported Yisachar. So there was that. In fact, even today, we have what are called Yisachar-Zebulun partnerships, which are done. I mean, in Eretz Yisrael in particular, where you enter into a partnership with somebody where you will support them on a one-to-one basis. And you'll get the schar, you'll share in the reward for the learning of Torah. And in order for this to work, it's supposed to be very formal. I mean, Rav Moshe has tshuvos about how the contract is drawn up. It should be a contract and everything else. Yeah.
The other thing, I was just wondering if you were suggesting that Sarah having Yitzchak is kind of like Avram having a bridge.
Yes, I'm suggesting that. I'm suggesting that the capacity to have children is connected, I don't want to say it's the female equivalent to circumcision, but on some conceptual level they are linked, because both involve the ability to be engaged in this worldly activity. and to elevate it and sanctify it, as opposed to the notion of asceticism, renunciation, mm-hmm. and withdrawal. They're both connected to sexual activity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You mentioned that hay is for a woman, yeah. Olam Hazeh.
No, hay is Olam Hazeh generally, for everybody.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then with the yud, Olam Ha, yeah. Would you say that that really is, you mentioned the hay and yud, with all the days, like the day of Ra, Olam Hazeh, Ra, Olam Haba.
Right.
In other words, he's connecting all the days. Olam Haba, the world to come,
mm-hmm.
and Olam Hazeh.
Yes,
so
that's correct.
With the one, they are really doing all the days.
That's right. That's correct. That everything is connected in us. Yeah.
You just said that the hay, speaking of Rabbi, could you make it with not being given? Yeah. That's a general statement, not specific. Would you...
No, all I meant to say is that the Gemara does not say hey for women is Olam Hazeh. The Gemara says the letter hey generally
for both
men and women. Of course,
but the
man doesn't have the man doesn't have the hey in his name.
Yeah, but yeah. It would apply to a woman.
That's correct.
Because it's Olam Hazeh,
that's
Olam
right.
Haba,
that's correct. That's correct. Okay. Hey is connection. Hey is the binding.
They may use just the material thing to be a competitive thing.
That's
if
right.
They make more and more money than some other man.
That's right.
But not use it in the
in a spirit, right. Which is why, yeah, that's correct, yeah.
I just had to
yeah.
finish up with,
yeah.
On this, how does that relate to the fact that it's Chavo's fate that results with pregnancy and sorrow and that kind of thing?
Well,
or doesn't, I mean, I don't know.
Well, you know, again,
you
yeah, well, again, I mean, fertility and childbirth and the pain that's associated are technically two different phenomena.
Okay.
The chait did not cause there to be the phenomenon of childbirth. The chait may have caused the extra
right.
pain that's involved.
Right.
But even then, that's, I think, very deeply true. In other words, because if the birth of children is a symbol of struggling with this world and trying to elevate it,
mm-hmm.
that's really the getter. The getter is that after the chait, sanctifying this world is going to be a struggle. In
mm-hmm.
other words, that's exactly it.
Right.
In other words, the struggle is going to be very, very great. And that's exactly the prototype of Olam Hazeh.
Well,
the only thing is, though, that, I mean, circumcision is for men who are Jewish and childbirth is for all women, so that it's not...
Well,
necessarily a covenant type of thing.
I understand. That's a good point. But maybe this suggests the capacity of all women to reach certain levels of integration.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, even non-Jewish women may have a certain capacity
mm-hmm.
As opposed to non-Jewish men. It might be so.
Could you explain the connection between, which I feel the same on my side, I can't see the connection between circumcision and a woman having a child?
Well, what we're saying is this. The notion of sanctifying the physical worlds, meaning getting involved in the mundane details of life and serving Hashem through them as opposed to withdrawing into yourself and into your private relation. The bris milah itself is the organ of a human being that is the sexual organ, that which is involuntary, that which seems to be animalistic. And the notion of the bris milah shows that we can sanctify the physical, most material part of ourselves. Childbirth is similar in this sense, that childbirth compels a mother or a parent to go beyond themselves and attend to many physical needs of a dependent, helpless infant. So, once again, you're serving Hashem by diapering the baby, by feeding the baby, by taking care of someone else. So that's the notion of serving Hashem, not by withdrawal.
But the struggle was because Eve was enticed to Adam. That's the pain of childbirth.
That was the reason for it. Well, it's not the reason for childbirth. There would have been childbirth anyway, but that's the reason for the pain of childbirth. That's a separate issue. Now, as you know, Christian theologians were against the use of anesthesia in the 19th century because they said it would contravene the curse of in pain shall you give birth to children. Right? That was never the Jewish approach. We don't...
A curse is not a mitzvah.
Huh?
A curse is not a mitzvah,
that's correct. It's a description of a
mm-hmm.
normal factual reality, but
right.
there's nothing against us. In fact, people even say that about the verse that says, he shall rule over you. In other words, that
mm-hmm.
verse that
mm-hmm.
people have some problems with. That's also... maybe, perhaps in the nature of part of the curse is not a mitzvah. In other words, the same way you can have anesthesia,
mm-hmm.
You don't have to have a relationship of that superiority there. Some also learn that that's a curse in the normal course of events, but it's not an inevitable reality.
But Rabbi, when the woman walks seven times around the man, yeah, in the marriage ceremony,
yes,
she is saying, in fact, that she is, you know...
Well, you know, it depends how you interpret that, though. In other words, some interpret the walking around seven times not as a submission, but they say the other way. There's a verse in Mishlei that says, Isha tisovev gever. A woman surrounds a man by protecting him from temptation. That's right. So she is protecting him in a spiritual sense. And in fact, the seven times corresponds, really. The seven things of tefillin, seven, and it corresponds to the verse in Hosea, Ve'irastech li le'olam. It says seven expressions. I will betroth you to me forever. With tzedek, with righteousness, be amuna, right? There's seven phrases there.
Is there anything that suggested it's submission? I have not heard that.
Some say it's a notion of submission because it says that in, but you know, but that doesn't have, this certainly doesn't have to be the end. There are many other interpretations that look at
yes,
it that
yes, it's
way.
There somewhere.
well, the truth is some of the more feminist types mm-hmm. interpret it as submission, but I think that's their problem.
Because it's not.
Because there are some, so-called progressive women who refuse to walk around the chasm because they say it's an act of submission. But again, I think that's bringing, you know, bringing their own problems to
no,
it. Because
I meant with the is that a
that's not the standard. The standard interpretation is it's based on the verse Isha Tisovev Gever mm-hmm. and the Arastach Li Leolim. And in fact, there's another interpretation that says, if anything, this is a more technical interpretation, but if anything, the walking around signifies the husband's obligations towards his wife, because Chazal enumerates seven obligations a husband has towards his wife, and she in effect is saying, I have seven ways to tie you up. So she is tying her husband up seven ways. So, and this is brought down specifically in Achronim, that it refers to the seven chiyuvim, the seven obligations. You know, support and burial and ransom. One of the obligations, this is interesting, I think there's a movie about this. One of the obligations in Chazal is if a woman is kidnapped, the husband must pay the ransom. Right? That's a chiyuv. Baruch Hashem, it doesn't happen that often today, but you know, for a lot of the Middle Ages and before, it was a common practice just to kidnap.
What about the two mothers? Yeah. Why do they have to walk around?
No, they don't. They're just holding. They're just holding the dress. The dress is.
That's the only reason.
That's all. It's it. The minhag is the kala walks around. The mothers don't.
That might be.
The protector.
Give them an honor. Okay.
If they don't want to walk around, how about them not getting married?
Not getting married. Well, all right.
If they don't want to walk around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, 7 days of the week, too, right?
That's another, yeah, the completion, right.
You know, I think Hindus have to also.
They have
circle.
A walking around circle.
I'm not sure about that, but maybe some of the interpretations are confused.
It could be, but as I say, the interpretations that I've seen for the seven times, some walk around three times. Some walk around 10 times. There are different customs about that. Do not connote submissiveness in that sense. But the fact that people interpret it a certain way, whatever they interpret it a certain way. But this notion of again sanctifying the physical is one of the great things about what marriage is supposed to bring, particularly to a man. Now it's interesting. We know statistically that women who are single do a lot better in life than men who are single. In terms of life expectancy and everything else, because it's very, very true that even physiologically speaking, men have a hard time in this world. The competitiveness of this world affects people, it drags them down, they're unable to make relationships and friends, etc. So it's...
But that doesn't mean they should remain single.
No, of course. But of course there's a... Yeah, what I'm saying is if you have choices, you know, yeah.
I just heard a study on, I think NPR, they said men who are married, if they're happy or not happy, get, no matter what, they're okay. Women have to be happy in order for the marriage
to be right. That's right. That's right. Because they could do fine without it. But marriage is supposed to add something. If it doesn't add something, then it's not who needs it. But man, I get something out of it one way or the other. That's right. Okay. All right. But anyway, this was that point I wanted to make about Balak, this concept of sanctifying, sanctifying the material, and what a difficult avoda it is. Because again, it's easier. Well, the example would be, you know, Yom Kippur. You know, it's a fast day, of course, there's certain hardships, but Yom Kippur, for many people, is a relatively easy day to serve Hashem properly. Because you are removed. That's exactly the concept. You're in shul all day, you're removed from the physical, and at the end of Yom Kippur, a person might be hungry and tired, but there's certainly almost a sadness in kind of having to come back. Rosh Hashanah, I've always found, is a harder Yom Tov than Yom Kippur. Because you're vacillating back and forth like a ping pong, where you know you have a long, very intense davening, then you got to eat, you know, then you got to go back to shul. You don't have that sustained momentum of the pure kedusha. You have to go in and out, and in and out, and in and out. And again, it's interesting that the phrase that is used to describe women, just to mention this another chazal, which is often misunderstood, there's a pejorative phrase, or a phrase that is interpreted pejoratively. Nashim datan kalos. Women are light-minded. This phrase, chazal, women are light-minded. So most interpret this in a negative way. You know, they're flighty, they can't concentrate, they're easily swayed. But I once saw a pshat, because really, it's really very, very, very nice. Datan kalos refers to a certain flexibility in which you can do a lot of different things at once. Again, I'm generalizing. The concept is that a man b'derech klal will get heavily invested in whatever they're doing at the time, whether it's reading the newspaper. Cooks of the world, because there's a soup on the stove or the tomato sauce, they'll stir it for 5 hours. They'll just sit over it for 5 hours. A woman doesn't have time. It's kind of going from thing to thing to thing to thing to thing. So datan kalos is considered to be a positive attribute for certain areas of life. It may not have the intensity. Again, it's even connected to Talmud Torah. In the ideal setting, Talmud Torah, intensive Talmud Torah, was supposed to be something that is all engrossing. In which that's the only thing, again, even the men very rarely reach this ideal, but the ideal was thought not to be proper for women because there were too many roles that had to be juggled. And as a result, the notion of full intensity and immersion was something that was not would not be appropriate for women. Again, this is just a possible explanation.
The experience, I think, that one can say is that when men, well, I would say, I used to say, where they read the newspaper, they can never hear anything, except if you don't want them to hear anything. Even though they're reading the newspaper, they heard.
Okay, yeah, people can.
They cannot do anything but the newspaper, except if they. You don't want them to hear something. Not that it's something.
Well, okay, that's the way it is. Yeah, people begin. Now they say the Stipler was deaf, and I remember visiting the Stipler Gaon, and we would communicate by writing, or I would write. You know, he would answer. But they say that whenever his wife spoke to him, he always heard. So I don't know if that was lip reading or whatever it was. But somehow he was attuned to
his study. Yeah. And they decided that women could handle as many as an average of 7 things at once, or men could only handle 3.
I tell you, I know myself. It's an amazing thing, and I can't analyze it exactly. When I have to get stuff for Havdalah, And for some reason, it's in a few different places. The line is here. I get a certain kind of anxiety. Just got to go here. You know. Like having to go to four places to get something is just something that's rankles a little bit.
There's a play out now with Penny McKay that goes into that extensively.
Right.
When I watch TV, I'm in the television, and if my wife is talking to me, he's aware of a faint buzzing noise.
Right, a buzzing noise.
He's not aware.
But that's the meaning of that. One of the meanings of dat and kalos, and indeed it might be connected to Talmud Torah.
I guess the reason everybody, you know, that makes people very nervous is, not just the feminists interpret it pejoratively, but many rabbis interpret it pejoratively
sure.
as well. And I think the fact that you found a chat like this is nice, that there's a nice chat out there, but I think there are a lot of not nice chats out there.
Well, listen, people interpret many, many things, and the words of Torah open to many interpretations.
Right.
But the point is, one just has to realize that the way something is interpreted is not necessarily what it means, and it's not necessarily the only interpretation.
Right.
And the positives can turn into the negatives, meaning to say, the negatives and the positives are not as far apart as you would assume.
Right, even if you say something in a not nice way, it could actually be a nice thing to say.
That's right. In fact, the flightiness may come from the ability to engage in many things simultaneously, which may be irritating on some levels too. Right. So they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but rather in that dimension there are positive and negative attributes.
How do you translate that into English?
Well, literally it means women, their minds are lights. Like kalot means lights, lightheaded. But lightheaded is the ability to
life means
here.
Also or.
Right. Right. No, well, light here refers to lack of weight.
I know, but
in other words, when your mind is weighted down, you're stuck on that thing and you can't move to the next thing. If your mind is light, it can go from here to there to there to there. Right. Well, it may mean that the nature of life. Again, we're not talking about biological reality so much, but the nature of life is you can't concentrate.
Yeah. I heard that women have the ability to pay attention to detail more than men, and the minute aspect of life, where the men tend to gloss over them.
That may be connected too to the fact that men focus on something, and therefore they don't see the peripheral details. There was a famous study. Carol Gilligan, a psychologist in Harvard, wrote a book called The Different Voice, where she even talked about the different perceptions of morality between boys and girls at a young age. She gave them a questionnaire about, let's say you had a child who needed medicine, and the medicine is in a drugstore that's closed for the night, the only drugstore in town that has it. And it's closed for the night, it's midnight, and you need it or the child might, God forbid, get very ill or die. So what would you do? So this was a questionnaire administered to 7-year-old boys and girls. So all the boys said, you take a stone, you take a rock, you break the window, and you take the medicine, which is of course right. In other words, they saw it as an either or. Do you take the medicine or does the child die? As an either-or question, the halacha is very, very clear. You take the medicine. But the girls weren't content with that. The girls said, well, of course we have to take the medicine, but don't we have to leave a note? Shouldn't we clean up the glass? Should we call the police and tell them ahead of time that we're doing this so they could let us in? In other words, the concept was that the man focused on the big issue and ignored some of the other ramifications, and the woman, the little girls, saw other aspects of the problem. She called this the distinction between Jake's Ladder and Charlotte's Web. Charlotte's Web is a children's book. That for the men it was a ladder, up, down, on, off, yes, no, as opposed to being cognizant of everything. And that's connected with Dayton Kalos, because many things have to be dealt with at once, many things have to be juggled, and that creates a certain confusion of the mind sometimes.
Would that tie into Aegis and
It's hard to give a comprehensive svara, but it might very well be a ties into Aedis, that women will try to integrate, they see Reuven kill Shimon, and they'll try to maybe construct some mental imagery of what happened before, what happened after, which may not be relevant to the actual case. Yeah, it may be connected to perception.
As far as what you think is the underlying
reason for this difference? Is it totally physiological? Is it a lot of it societal? I mean, your view on that.
Well, again, I think we have to believe that Hashem made men and women with different capacities, and because it is only in the union that there could be a perfection. You know, to have a female or a male clone of yourself, actually there's no such thing as a clone of yourself, wouldn't be meaningful, because it would just be doubling what you already have. It is the divergent perspective that creates shleimus. In fact, this is the meaning of Ezer Kenegdo. Ezer Kenegdo means a helpmate that is opposite. So Chazal already pointed out that that's a contradiction. Helpmate or opposition? So Chazal's answer is relatively simple. If you're lucky, there's Ezer. If you're not lucky, you get opposition. But in the Hasidic Svarim, they make the point that the Ezer, the help of marriage, is kenegdo, is in opposition. We don't mean dissension, we don't mean arguments, mm-hmm. but we mean in the divergent perspectives, there is perfection. That each brings out characteristics in the other. It is through the integration of differential ways of behaving that we achieve certain growth.
Well, are there male and female souls? Or are there just male and female bodies?
Well, are you referring to the issue of the sex change problem? Or,
No.
I think there are male and female tendencies, and within any given neshama, there are masculine and feminine tendencies, but the idea of a male is the masculine would be dominant with some feminine, and the female would be dominant with some masculine, meaning it's not these are not totally disembodied, separated elements, but there are elements of both.
You know, in today's interpretation, it's kenegdo means, which means female and not man, gay.
Well, Chumash says Hashem made Chava, he's a kenegdo, it doesn't say, But the thing is that, that's the Aveda of Ezer kenegdo. So in fact, when one seeks a mate, one should not seek, you know, an exact duplicate of oneself. Otherwise, why get married? You know, there's a little toy that they sell in businesses, a little doll that you wind up and it says, you know, you're always right. You put it on your desk if you feel that. You're always right. You're always correct. You have perfect ideas. You have this thing that constantly tells you how perfect you are. You could buy a toy. All right. Okay, so that was one point about what Balak was afraid of, the notion of sanctity. By the way, it might also be related why Gemara says, remember we read yesterday about the daughters of Tzelafchad? The daughters of Tzelafchad came to Moshe and they wanted a share in the land of Israel, and the Gemara makes the point that women had a greater love for the land of Israel than the men. The men with the spies wanted to stay. It could very well be that if Eretz Yisrael represents the idea of serving Hashem by sanctifying the material world, the men wanted to stay in the desert. The women said, let's translate this into the reality. And it might be connected to why, and in fact we see this even today. Again, generalizations, but it's not an uncommon pattern that a woman would be more committed to Aliyah than her husband. Again, Chazal say, Noshim Mechavavos Es Haaretz. Women have a greater love for Eretz Yisrael than men often do. Now there's another point about Bilam that I want to make. This is also a beautiful point. And that is, Bilam is a strange person in a lot of ways. Bilam on one level is said to be the consummate professional. In fact, we talk about lawyers as being a hired gun. In other words, the lawyer will represent anybody who you want. And in fact, according to Chazal, Bilam had once cursed Moab on behalf of somebody else. In other words, if you remember, part of Moab's land was captured by Sichon, the king of the Emori, and that was the land that 2.5 tribes took over. So in other words, when Sichon hires him to curse Moab, he curses Moab. So Moab is the worst, you know, nation in the world. Then Moab hires him, he works for Moab. Exactly like the attorney, the hired gun, who will work for whoever hires him. A mercenary who has no principles except for his own.
Why God gave him this power?
I'll come to that. It definitely is a power. In fact, some say the word Bil'am is Bili'am. Without a nation, he owes no allegiances. Half curse will travel. He will go anywhere. So on one level, Bilam represents cool professionalism. He's very good at his job. The other thing we see about Bilam, though, is that Bilam was given a power by Hashem. And in fact, the Rashi brings an amazing thing, that why did Hashem give this power to a Bilam? Because the nations of the world are going to come to God, or would come to God and say, if you would have given us a leader of the caliber of a Moshe Rabbeinu, we would be righteous. Therefore Hashem said, I will give you somebody who is as great in prophecy as Moshe. And you will see that there is still free will in the world. And you can use the greatest gifts for evil. So Bilam, on some level, was of the magnitude of a Moshe Rabbeinu in terms of his perception, his understanding, his prophecy. But this teaches you, right? This teaches you that prophecy and intellect and vision does not make a person good. That is ultimately a function of their free will. Moshe didn't have to turn out like Moshe Rabbeinu. It was his bechira, his free will. Right? So that's the second idea, but that Bilam was a tremendously great person in terms of his innate ability. But the third thing we see about Bilam is, and this was his downfall, that Bilam was a person who was consumed by his passions and his desires and his greed. This is a text in Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos identifies three attributes that make a person a disciple of Avraham Avinu, and the opposite make a person a disciple of Bilam. It uses Bilam in particular. The three positive attributes of Avraham Avinu is called Ayin Tova. Ayin Tova means a generous eye. That means you get pleasure when other people have good things happen to them. You're not jealous. You actually enjoy other people's good fortune. That's a generosity of spirit. The second is Ruach Shefala. That is humility, where you don't have pride or gaiva. And the third is, Ruach Nemucha. And the third is Nefesh Shefala. Nefesh Shefala does not mean humility, that's Ruach Nemucha. But Nefesh Shefala means you're not excessively lustful for pleasures of this world, money or whatever it is. Now the opposite, which are the three midos of Bilam, are called Ayin Ra'a, that's jealousy, where you begrudge people's good fortune. Ruach Gavoha, which is pride, gaiva, arrogance. And the third is Nefesh Rechava, taiva, lust. In fact, this corresponds to the three midos, jealousy, kina. Right? Kina corresponds to Ayin Ra'a, jealousy. Ruach Gavoha corresponds to kavod, a desire for honor. And nefesh, rechava, an expansive soul, corresponds to taiva. Right? Those are the three forces that take a person out of this world. So imagine the predicament of Bilam, and we see this in the world. So Bilam was a man of immense talents. But those urges, that selfishness, the egotism, the jealousy, the arrogance, they were demons, as it were, that were destroying him from within. Very tortured in a way.
I once heard that Bilam and Balak were the same people.
Same person?
Yeah.
You know, I've never heard that. I'd have to check. That would be very, very interesting how to interpret the verses of Balak talking to Bilam. I'll try to check that. I've never heard that. That might be a very interesting point. So you see that Bilam, on one hand, has the veneer of the cool professional, tremendous innate abilities, but is literally being torn apart by the struggles that are going on inside. In fact, Chazal learned, by the way, that Bilam had tremendous taivas. I mean, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Bilam at first, don't go with these people, like Bilam doesn't tell them that Hashem said I can't go, but he kind of hints, if you offer me more money, maybe I'll go. He says, even if you'd offer me all the money in your palace, I wouldn't go. But he's suggesting, they didn't offer that. In other words, he's suggesting what they should offer and everything else. So the tragedy, Bilam in effect is a tragic figure, because it does tell you that a human being can have tremendous abilities, but if he doesn't learn how to control the raging passions within, they will destroy him. And in, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I was thinking what you said about him being sort of lawyerly-like, and
right.
I think that, you know, that actually the ethics rules kind of address that, because mm-hmm. they now require that you do a very close check on, you know, like a conflict of interest, and that right. would have been maybe suitable for that.
In other words, he shouldn't have taken the Moabite job because he represented the other... yeah, well... That's right. Well, maybe the ABA would have changed that, but of course the ABA doesn't license sorcerers, I think. But now let me say this. Now, it's very interesting that according to one Hasidic sefer, what Bilam was doing to Bnei Yisrael was exactly his own curse, and that is to say the following. There's a Gemara in Brachos that says, "What was Bilam's great talent?" Bilam knew there's apparently 1 second of the day where Hashem has anger over the world. And if you curse at that moment, you're tapping into the anger. So it says Bilam knew exactly when that second was. And that's why he was so successful. Apparently everything else was preliminary to that second.
Yeah. So whenever Hashem doesn't change, so that if he has anger in 1 second, there would be no change, wouldn't it?
Well, there is a verse in Tehillim that we say every day. This, Ki rega biapo. God's anger is only for a rega, only for a second.
But I know that.
Well, we're not referring to God's emotional changing, that's true. We are referring to God's manifestation in behavior, meaning to say, God will behave a certain way. That's it. Now, Tosfos asks,
why did he give it to Bilam? Well,
I told you. Bilam was the Moshe. Well, because again, he wanted a prophet like Moshe Rabbeinu. But Tosfos asks an obvious question. What could Bilam say in a second that would work? In other words, you have to say something in that second. So Tosfos says he could have said one word. He could have said Kalem. Now, Kalem is not with a kuf. Kalem is chaf. Lamed men. Kalei means kaleotam, destroy them. Okay, that's what he could have said. Now, the thing is this. I saw from Shlomo Yosef 7, Zatzal, that Kalei could be understood as an acronym, an abbreviation. Kaf is kaleos, kidneys. Lev is hearts. And mem is moach, minds. That kaleos, lev, moach. Now, kalayos, kidneys in ancient anatomy, as it were, the kidneys were always represented as the seat of passion and desire, of lust. Lev are emotions generally, and moach is the intellectual and moral sense of a human being. Bilam said, the greatest curse I could bring upon a human being is that their mind, their intellectual and moral capacity is subordinated to their passions and their lusts. And he knew that was the greatest curse because that what was going through himself. Kala'im? Kala'im is Kaf Lamed Mem. Kaf Lamed Mem. Now, what's the opposite of Kala'im? Go in reverse. Melech. King. What is a king? A king is Moach, Lev, Kala'os. The mind, meaning the intellectual and moral sensibility, rules the kidneys and the heart, rules the emotions. That you control the emotions so that they do what the mind dictates is the morally proper thing to do. And that's literally when we say God reversed Bilam's curse into a blessing. That means the curse of Kalein became the blessing of Melech. If you look in Bilam's blessings, you'll see many times that he refers to the Jewish people and their relationship with God as Melech. And of course we know that this Pirkei Avos says, Ezehu Gibor, that Gibor, heroism, strength, is the ability to be kovesh, to conquer and dominate the Yetzer, the inclination that is within. That is called a milchama, that is called a war. The Mishlei writes about it all the time. Mishlei describes, Umoshel Berucho Milocheid Ir. He who can rule over his spirit is greater than the conqueror of a city. The Chovas HaLevavos brings that when a general came back from war, Umoshel Berucho Milocheid Ir. The Chovas HaLevavos brings that when a general came back from a military victory, A great sage came out to greet him and said, "Now you have finished a small battle, and you must begin a big battle, a battle within yourself." And again, there are many, many, again, this is a theme that is really obvious, how difficult it is to deal with the enemy within. Edmund Steindl says that, he quotes somebody who once told him, he was learning with somebody, and the person once said, "Why is there such a fascination with outer space?" And he says, "Because we like to look at outer space because the inner space is too difficult. The inner halal within us is too difficult to deal with, so we look at the outer space." So that is the curse. That's what a melech is. A melech is moach leiv kalayos, as opposed to kalayos, right? Kalayos leiv moach. The notion of, now we don't mean by saying the mind controlling the heart. I mean that's a little, you can get the wrong impression there. The mind controlling the heart might suggest that one should be, you know, emotionless, without feeling, just be a creature of the mind. Not really, but rather the mind, we refer to not just intellectualism, but the moral sense of life should dictate your feelings, as opposed to, you know, your feelings dictating your behavior. Because when feelings dictate behavior, we will tend to gravitate to what is comfortable and what is convenient and what is easy. And we will tend to then rationalize that what makes me feel good is what Hashem wants me to do. Now, it's impossible for us to escape that subjectivity, and that's why only a real melech can do it. But to some degree, we have to try to learn to look at God's will in as objective a way as we can fathom, whether, you know, it's easy or whether it's difficult.
No, I was just thinking that the Kalim is nice, because then still on later, when he doesn't succeed with the curse, he gets the winning.
That's right.
So then he didn't get it with the curse, so he just
that's right,
have it
that's
right.
That that's, right. That's exactly the connection, yeah. That he says, well, listen, I couldn't curse them, mm-hmm. but have them sexually enticed, and that's going to turn them into that. So anyway, mm-hmm. creatures of passion, and in that sense, everything is going to be all right. Let me just end with one other thought. I mentioned this in show yesterday, but I think it's something we should think about during the 3 weeks in particular. Yesterday we read the story of Pinchas. Pinchas sees the head of Shimon and a Midianite woman who are publicly really fornicating, and based on the halacha, he kills them. Now this is a halacha that is very, very unique and very limited. In fact, when you ask a shayla, let's say you see something and you ask a shayla, you pull out your gun, should I do it? You would be told no. And not only that, but if it's achar hamaisa, if they already completed their action, you can't do it either. It's only during the action itself, there's a heter called Kanayin Poigenbay, a zealous person can do it. But we know that the Torah emphasizes Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron. And Rashi asks the question, why does it say the son of Aaron? Because normally you don't go to the grandfather, just say Pinchas, the son of Elazar. And Rashi's explanation is because the tribes made fun of Pinchas. And they said, hey Pinchas, your own mother was the daughter of Yisro. See, Elazar married another one of Yisro's daughters. So your grandfather, your maternal grandfather, was a Midianite man who sacrificed Avodah Zarah. Who do you think you are? You're so righteous? And therefore the Torah says, well, let's not look at the Elazar connection. Let's look at the Aaron connection. But the question is, of course, that's a non sequitur. That's non-responsive. I mean, if their argument is he has this black sheep in his family, then you don't address that by saying, well, he has a white sheep in his family. So the Ksav surface has a very important insight. That when the Shvatim accused Pinchas of his maternal grandfather being an idol worshiper, they're not simply saying, you know, you have no right to act, but they're saying, your motives are not pure. Because you're doing this to establish your reputation, to be part of the in-group. In other words, imagine Pinchas, who has this taint that he comes from an idol worshiper. What better way can he establish his credentials? By showing righteous indignation towards the idol worshippers and those who are committing zinus. So the accusation is, your zealousness was not for the sake of God. Your zealousness was because you were serving your own agenda. And the Torah is being made that Pinchas' personality came from Aaron. In fact, the way you translate it according to this is not that he was the son of Elazar, who was the son of Aaron, but Pinchas was genealogically a son of Elazar. Spiritually, he he was the son of Aaron. Aaron, of course, is the lover of peace, the pursuer of peace, the one who would never want to bring pain on another person. And therefore, Pinchas didn't do this because he wanted to do it. Pinchas did it because he had to do it. But it was against every fiber of his being. In other words, the concept is that the notion of being a zealot has to be because you love Hashem and you love the Jewish people. And you want to help them and you want to benefit them. And you want to save them from suffering. Remember, there's a plague. People are dying right and left. Until Pinchas acted, more and more people would die. 24,000 people died before Pinchas acted. And therefore, the Torah is being made that when you are zealous because it furthers your ego, or it makes you feel good, or it makes you feel superior to others, that is not zealousness for Hashem. That is considered to be selfish, and indeed, the act becomes an act of murder. The same act can either be Kiddush Hashem or it could be murder. And I mentioned before, Rav Chaim used to say that a true zealot and a false zealot can be compared to a housewife and a cat. If I buy a cat to kill mice, the cat hopes there'll be plenty of mice it could rip up. The one who buys the cat would very much hope there would be no mice at all. The false kanoi loves finding fault in people, to expose them and to embarrass them and to uncover them, convincing themselves they are acting l'shem shamayim, when it's really a way of avoiding the difficult issue of looking into yourself. The true kanoi does not get joy in people's shortcomings. They do what needs to be done, but it's always with a sense of sadness. And I hope that B'nai Yisrael will do tshuva. So, again, it's something to think about, particularly in the 3 weeks, when we recall the sinas chinam, the hatred that exists among the Jewish people. We have to remember that righteous indignation is very often a destructive feeling, the concept of looking at others and trying to identify how much more righteous we are, because it's always easier to blame the other person, why there's no Mashiach, why there's no redemption. And part of what the 3 weeks calls upon us to do is to look into ourselves, to see what we can do to build the Beis HaMikdash, and how we can help other people, but not necessarily identify agendas for them to do in order to bring the Geula. Uh-huh. That a kanos, a zealousness that is not motivated by a love for B'nai Yisrael, is ultimately destructive, and indeed it's even sinful.
I think I learned this on my own, that when somebody has like a father or something,
that
go to grandfather, so
it's
not to embarrass them by using
their name,
but use the grandfather's name.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about for an aliyah? Yeah. Yeah, right? That's correct, yeah. So that's why, in other words, that's why you're saying it connected Pinchas to his grandfather. Pinchas, the son of Elazar. That might be so, although it does mention Elazar. It says Pinchas, the son of Elazar, this son of Aaron. It doesn't just skip.
But you know, Elazar. The covenant of priesthood was given to Pinchas, not to Aaron. Aaron was anointed.
Well, okay.
And the new covenant was given to Pinchas.
Well, but there's a technical reason for that, because the concept is Aaron was anointed, and from then on, anyone that's born from an anointed Kohen is a Kohen. Pinchas was born before Elazar was anointed. So Pinchas was not born from a Kohen. Elazar did not become a Kohen till he was anointed. And that's why Pinchas was not a Kohen till he killed Zimri. In fact, it worked out for the best, really. I'll tell you why. Because there is a halacha in Shulchan Aruch that if a Kohen kills a person, even accidentally, he is puzzled from being a Kohen. Aye, how could Pinchas be a Kohen? The answer is, when Pinchas killed Zimri, he wasn't a Kohen yet. And therefore, he was able to be anointed. So it worked out very, very well that Pinchas was not legally a Kohen until that point. Yeah.
If we have within this world, later in there's the Holy of Holies now, through the manifestation of the arch, we now have the Holy of Holies that has been excavated, and there is the feet that was praying on the inside portion now of the temple area. So would you say that there's a rebuilding in time of Mashiach?
Well, I'm just not sure where that area is. I mean, obviously, we would not be allowed to enter. You're not under it.
Where the praying is not at the Holy of Holies, but both have been excavated. And the men fetch it through an arch.
Uh-huh. So we're davening under the Holy of Holies? The Holy of Holies is higher?
I don't know, but that's reluctantly correct. But the Holy of Holies has been excavated. Mm-hmm. There is now praying in the inside portion of the temple.
Well, I think those are signs. You know, it's hard to know, but those are signs of we may be approaching the building of the Beis HaMikdash.
Hashem says, Mekasi Brit Shalom.
Yep.
Is that because he acted out of bringing peace?
Yes, that's a good point. I think you have to say that, because how could an act of violence create a covenant of peace? The answer is that his motivation was to bring peace. His motivation was love of, not only L'shem Shemayim, but it was actually for love of Bnei Yisrael, to spare them. That's what it says. What does the Torah say? Heshiv es chamasi. He removed my anger from Bnei Yisrael. L'chein emor. That's why I will give him a covenant of peace. That's Stam a question. What exactly is a bris shalom? What is a covenant of peace? What does that mean? So one might be that he would have an inner calmness and serenity. The other would be that as a Kohen, he would always have the capacity to bring shalom between Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right, there are different interpretations of what the bris shalom is. Of course, we know Pinchas became Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu HaNavi never died.
And he lived also at the time of Yiftach, right?
That's right. And so Pinchas is Eliyahu HaNavi, and he will be the harbinger of the Mashiach. He will bring the Mashiach.
Eliyahu was going to be
That's right.
So that was also a very violent confrontation.
That's right, and in fact,
for Hashem.
That's how we know. Chazal say, because Eliyahu HaNavi after Mount Carmel uses the same phrase, Kano Kinesi L'Hashem, I was zealous for God. Mm-hmm. And Chazal criticized him, say he was too critical of the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. Because he said, as Brischa Hefeu, they have annulled your covenants. They have ignored your covenants. So Hashem condemned Eliyahu HaNavi to go to every bris and every Seder, so he should know that even Jews who are not that observant do try to keep the covenant of Hashem. This is why he goes to bris, because he said, as bris chayfer, Hashem said, you have to be melameid schus, you have to look at the Jewish people favorably.
But Hashem was the person who was, or God punished, Melech HaFarad, for being too zealous for Hashem, and he would have killed all the Jewish people. He was too zealous for Hashem.
Well, Eliyahu HaNavi himself was replaced. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him to anoint Elisha after Eliyahu HaNavi said, I have no faith in the Jewish people. I mean, you see this, that when the leader has no faith in the people. In fact, according to many Mefarshim, that was the chait of Moshe Rabbeinu hitting the rock. He basically gets replaced exactly at that moment. Okay, well, have a good week and be well.
And we have a class next week.
I was just wondering, you know, in the headlines right now, is that book the Bible Code?
Yeah.
I wanted to know what your thoughts on it were.
Oh, you know, this is such an example. Yeah. First of all, it's kind of adapted from the Asia Torah Discovery Seminars that have been going around. But it just shows you how much a person strains not to be a believer. The guy happens to be an atheist.
He's an atheist, exactly.
So he says, I have all these discoveries. Yeah, there must have been aliens from Mars who gave us this code. So it shows you a person could see all sorts of things, and if you don't want to believe it, don't believe it. But, you know, is it? I didn't examine it in detail, but I know from the Asian Torah Discovery, is it possible that Hashem encoded the future events in the Torah? I have no doubt.
I was in Barnes & Noble, I read the first 20 pages, so this is all I know. But yeah. He suggests that Eliyahu Rips, who's the mathematician, he's basing everything on him, suggests that Hashem put the code in and was not supposed to be discovered until we have a computer, and that it's now a successive revelation.
I think that's very possible. The concept is that as future generations get weaker in Emunah, Hashem gives us mechanisms by which we can confirm Emunah. I think it's a very, very possible way.
It's very interesting.
In fact, the Chafetz Chaim used to say with the discovery of radio or the invention of radio and telegraph, why did we have it? So he says, because in modern generations, people begin to say, well, can Hashem really hear my prayers so far away? So we show messages can go from one end of the world to the other. It's a way of giving people a mental picture that things can travel in these invisible ways. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, I appreciate people could say a chapter or two of Tehillim. Yeah, thank you for that.
Rabbi, if I wanted to have a post,
I don't know who it is.
He's not telling us.
Sure. You just have to be sure that it's not conflicting with an existing schedule. But you can tell me a time and...
Yes, did you want us to do it?
Usually, by and large, the show is available for any shiur.
No.
Yeah.